Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. You know, today I want to talk to you about crowds. There's some stuff that has come to my attention when I think about what it's like. We think about how important it is to belong to something. Belong to a family. Belong to a mate. Belong to something. Your own group. A workplace. We all need something to belong to, it seems. Not many people, though. There are some people who don't believe that. There are some people who believe they're just alone. You know, and they live alone. And they, you know, if they'll join with people if necessary. But they're very comfortable being very alone. Well, what happens when your group becomes a club, when your club becomes a crowd? That becomes a very interesting question. When I was a kid, we hung out on corners, on street corners. And we had a crowd, which was called a gang. It was just a group of guys. But you were perceived as dangerous. Just because you were a group of male energy gathered in one spot. Let's talk about what's happened with crowds and the whole belief about crowd behavior and what's happened in this world. You know, the protests that took place on the streets of London on the eve of the G20 summit in April, it lived up to so many people's expectations. Around 2,000 protesters turned up and were heavily marshaled by the police. There's a bit of trouble, but when the police tactics, specifically the decision to corral the entire crowd into a small area near the Bank of England, an approach known as kettling, which we'll talk about, kept a lid on this violence. Kettling. Kettling is like putting steam and fire into a small space. So you kettle. You create a kettle, and the kettle kind of has this tendency to blow off. Well, that was the official version that I just told you about, and it reflects a belief that crowds, you know, it reflects this belief about crowds that's shared by the police, the governments, and to a large degree, the general public around the world. The trouble is seen as especially likely when something goes wrong at a large gathering, and under these circumstances, like you're at a football match or you hear at a soccer match, there's a fight, and then people get crushed in a panic, or the bull run, people get hurt, or things that happen. We have this concept of an unruly mob. And this concept goes all the way back to many of the theories about crowd behavior, the original theories about crowd behavior. Some of the original theories about crowd behavior is that when a person joins a crowd, they lose their mind and they go into a group mind. And the group mind forms itself, and that crowd then takes on a life of its own mind. The unruly mob concept is usually taken as you read it and used as a basis for crowd control measures and evacuation procedures around the world. The whole idea is control the mob, control the people, put up the barricades. I remember when we were protesting the Iraq war, there were many of us, WBAI and a whole gang of folks, and we were marching down with our, and they started corralling us. They started putting up barricades. And we were fine. It was a loving experience, this protest. It was peaceful. It was fine. And then they kept boxing you in. They would only let us walk down a certain part of 2nd Avenue, then a certain part of 1st Avenue. And then you couldn't walk over here, and you couldn't walk over there. And you couldn't go on the grass or the lawn because we would ruin the lawn at Central Park. And it was like this behavior happened, and there were no real breakouts of violence. But the feeling was beginning to bubble, not because of the people being so loaded, but because of the very behavior to control people. Kind of the problem with controlling people. The problem with controlling people who might well be under control as is. If you put too many controls on them, they might eventually be forced to rebel. I think that happens at work sometimes. You're at work and you have a perfectly good, peaceful. I remember I was speaking to a man who was in, he was in a new software business in a computer company, and the company does fine in teens, in jeans and t-shirts. And then all of a sudden they were bought out by another company who insisted that their productivity would increase if everybody had a dress code. And they put this dress code in. And the people began stealing things. They wouldn't have taken things. Otherwise, they were perfectly casual. They were reacting to it. Sometimes too much control creates a reaction, especially control when it's not necessary. So when facing an emergency, people in a crowd, get this, are more likely to cooperate than to panic. It's often actions such as kettling that leads to violence, the breaking out. But the thing that we've learned is that people in crowds are civil. I remember right after 2001, the attacks of 2001, I was in a movie theater. Must have been maybe 4 months, but we were all scared. You know, we're all on edge because there's going to be a bomb somewhere or anthrax somewhere, and somebody was going to do something to you at any moment. And I was watching a movie. I was in a movie theater. And a man steps into the middle of the movie theater and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, would you please evacuate the theater immediately?" Huh. You want to get scared? A guy stands in the middle of a theater and says, "Please evacuate." Evacuate, not leave. Evacuate. All right. Well, the most amazing thing happened. Everybody stood up and walked out very, very quietly, taking care of each other. I was amazed at how graceful this took place. How gracefully this took place. Because that's what people are really like. People are not this unruly mob. There's a psychologist, Stephen Reicher, pronounced Reicher, who studies group behavior at the University of St. Andrews. He said, in many ways, crowds are the solution. Rather than being prone to irrational behavior and violence, members of a crowd undergo a kind of identity shift that drives them to act in their own best interests of themselves and everyone around them. This identity shift is often strongest in times of danger or threat. The mad mob is not an explanation, but it's a fantasy, he said. There is no mad mob. All of this, you know, has profound implications for policing and the management of public events. The classic view of crowd psychology, which is still believed, talks about the loss of selfhood that happens, leaving people at best out of control and at the worst generally violent as soon as there's a gathering. Potentially. Reicher says, this is not only wrong, it's also counterproductive. If you believe all crowds are irrational and that even rational people are liable to be dangerous in them, then you'll treat them accordingly, often harshly, and stop people doing things they have a right to do, and that can lead to violence. And if you believe all crowds are irrational and treat them accordingly, it can lead to violence. And just think about, of course, you know, think about some of the civil rights marches. And if a civil rights march was allowed to take place, that's one thing. But the corralling and the kettling and the gathering and what took place and how it took place. All that said, there's no question that a part of any group can sometimes lead people to do appalling things. And we've had some things like mob behavior. We've had criminal things. But, you know, you hear about one thing and you don't know about the 1,000 things that took place where this didn't take place. Crowd violence is very rare. If 100 football matches happen on a Saturday and there is violence at one of them, guess which one it'll appear in the front page of the newspaper, right? Widespread panic during crowd emergencies is also uncommon and only occurs in certain circumstances when the escape routes are closed. That's a big one. That's what happened in India. When you don't have the escape routes, then people tend to evacuate. You know, it's kind of an interesting thing when you think about agoraphobia, right? One of the great fears is, how can I get out of here? Right? It's a common element. If you think about dogs and cats and little animals, one of the things you're looking for is, where's the exit? I think every animal that happens to be in nature that might have predators has some consideration in the back of their head, how do I get out of here in case the stuff hits the fan? You know, if that leopard suddenly decides to turn around and have me to lunch, where do I go? So I think we all are considering always, where's our exit? Where are the doors? It's interesting, on airplanes, they tell you to check the exits. You know, check where the exits are. It's a natural thing. Check your exits. Now, Tricia Wackendorf, that's her name, at the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware in Newark, yes, said, in most situations, particularly those involving large numbers of strangers, the crowd ends up behaving more remarkably sensibly than those controlling it. Think about somebody trying to kettle, and I saw this happen with the police all through the 60s and the 70s when they were on horses. The horses panic. Right? So here they are trying to control you, and they're trying to push you into a small area, and the horses don't see an exit. So the horses behave erratically. And erratic horses, and men on erratic horses, are getting agitated, and they're getting scared, and they think, oh, the mob is agitating my horse. See? And the horse starts reacting in certain ways, and the people are reacting to the horses, these monsters, these 3,000-pound monsters that are, you know, crowding them and forcing them into small areas. Evidence against the irrationality of crowd has been building for some time, and it has just kind of appeared that all that we believed is wrong. A team led by a guy named John Drury at the University of Sussex in London talked to survivors of 11 crowd-based disasters or near disasters, including the 1989 Hillsborough Stadium crush that killed 96 soccer fans and a free concert by Fatboy Slim on Brighton Beach in 2002 that was swamped by 250,000 people who went to this free concert. Four times as many as expected, and led to about 100 injuries out of 250,000 people. In each case, most interviewees recalled a strong sense of unity with the people around them as a result of their shared experience, and they remembered, every one of them, how much caring there was around them, how much cooperation there was, even though they got hurt. They talked about that it wasn't, rather than being competitive or antagonistic, people did their best to be orderly and courteous. Here's what we're learning, people. We're learning that all these rules about us, all these beliefs about us, all these theories about us were meant to keep us within a certain illusion of control, are in itself causing the reactions that people are having to deal with. If I see a breakout of crowd control, I'm going to ask myself, who was controlling the crowd? And that's where I will look to see the blame. Do people lose their minds? Do people have this? Does it really disappear? Let's take a look at moshing. Right? Moshing. Now, you know what moshing is, for those of you who don't know. Moshing is like slamming. It refers to an activity in which an audience members of a live performance aggressively push or slam into each other. Moshing is accompanied by stage diving, crowd surfing, it's called, smashing instruments, head banging, It's associated with concerts by hardcore punk, heavy metal, and rock artists in general. A mosh pit is a performance of the act of moshing in a pit-like fashion. Now, when you look at a mosh pit, you say to yourself, my God, look at the violence of that, smashing into each other and crawling on top of each other. But if you look real closely, there's a great deal of care being exerted to make sure no one gets hurt. You don't read signs about two killed in a moshing experience. No, there's something that happens to crowds, that when the crowds are put to the test, we care about each other. We love each other. You see, my friends, that's what I believe. I believe humans are good. I believe that what we do very often is a reaction to some assumption about us. So let's take a look at what these theories are. And I also want to talk to you about your own experience of crowd behavior and your own self in crowds. Convergence theory. Convergence theory holds that crowd behavior is not a product of the crowd itself, but it's carried into a crowd by particular individuals. Thus, crowds amount to a convergence of like-minded individuals. In other words, like contagion theory states that crowds cause people to act in a certain way, convergence theory says the opposite. People who wish to act in a certain way come together to form a crowd. Which do you think it is? Do you think the crowd has its own mind? Or do you think it's the people coming into the crowd with their mind set one way or another? See, so that's a real example of it. An example of convergence theory states that there are no homogeneous activity within a repetitive practice. Think about this. Think about an immigrant population. Common is a previously homogeneous era, and members of the existing community band together to threaten those trying to move into other neighborhoods. In such cases, you know, like what happens? So here you are, you're in your neighborhood, and suddenly a new culture wants to move into your neighborhood. And suddenly, so people want to move in, and then suddenly you object a little bit. I love the, I think it was Rosie who said, once described the attitude, it was in the movie Home, H-O-M-E, the movie, which, by the way, is a wonderful example of Frank McCord, some wonderful words by Frank McCord. Those of you who are Frank McCord fans, you practically get uninterrupted an hour of Frank McCord and his attitudes in that movie. It's called Home, the movie. And in this movie, Rosie said, the Puerto Ricans came along. She said, first the Irish were there, and then the Italians came along, and the Irish said, what are we going to do about the Italians? And then the Germans, the Italians were there, and the Germans came along, and they said, what are we going to do about these Germans? And then the Germans were along, and then suddenly, I'm sure it didn't happen in that sequence, but by the time the Puerto Ricans came along, everybody was tired of doing something about everything, and they just said, just leave them alone. And she talked about how easily Puerto Ricans were assimilated into the culture, because by then, people were just tired of fighting off the next group that came in. If there was any such thing, we believed, as I was a kid, that there was something wrong with anybody who was different. Strange, strange group. How has it affected you? Well, it's affected you in many ways, all of you. All of you have gotten affected by some belief, some theory, some prejudice, something that has said to you over and over again that there's only a certain one way to be. Here's my belief. In a group of people, in a crowd, people will be kind. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. There's two things I want to ask you for today. First, I want you to write down a phone number. A phone number for during the marathon, the fun drive, which is about to happen. We're going to be asking people to answer telephones during the fun drive. I want to ask the people who are fans of the Positive Mind specifically, to call the station and give whatever time that you have. Now, early next week, I will not be on Tuesday and Wednesday, but I will be with you on Thursday doing a two-hour special. And I could use volunteers to answer phones. But the station could always use volunteers to answer phones. In order to do that, you have to call and register as a volunteer, because they don't let just anybody up. And to do that, you have to call 212-209-2826. There's a crowd behavior for you. The crowd of people answering the phones. And when those phones go ringing off the hook, there's a little bit of panic, and people join together. Our telephone number here is 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. I want to be talking to you about your experience in crowds and what's happened with you in crowds. And when I say talking about you, I mean talking about you, not talking about them, not talking about just how bad everybody is, but what happened to you. 212-209-2900. You could start calling now. I'll take one of your calls. We're doing an unusual engineering stint today, working from a different studio down there. But let's try one of your calls if you're there. Hi, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air.
Hi, Armand DeMille. This is Joyce calling from Brooklyn.
Hello,
Joyce. I have a question, and it's not really about crowd control, but you just mentioned something about communities and people who, groups of people who are not that familiar and want to run you out of the neighborhood. I live in Brooklyn. I grew up with all sorts of ethnic groups. In Brooklyn, and I realize that you're probably Italian-American, I don't want to say anything insulting against Italians. I have Italian in my family and Italian friends, but I'd like your take on what it is with the Brooklyn-based, I guess it's the low income, that's the low or, I don't want to say middle class Italians, because I don't think they're the ones, but what is it about the backward-mindedness of Italians, specifically in Brooklyn, when it comes to violence against ethnic groups? Because it's one thing not to like or to move away, not to like different groups that are coming in, if they're Chinese, if they're Puerto Rican, if they're this or that. But what is it, do you think? Because I've even spoken to Italians who don't
get what it is.
I
know what you're talking about. And there's something about, not just the Italians, but there's something about the uneducated. You know, you have a family tries to protect itself. And families always try to, they become insular when they don't have much of an education. And I remember the prejudice that we had where I was coming from. We would talk about people as if we expected them to have green ears. You know what I mean?
Where are you from, Armand?
I'm from the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
I see.
So we would think of, you know, it was just, of course, what happened over time. What happened over time is I became more knowledgeable. But how did I become knowledgeable? Because I was exposed to so much more.
What I don't understand, Armand, is why is it that over the years, this year, God willing, I'll be 60, but I mean, this has been going on my entire life.
Yeah, sure.
Even to this day, there are enclaves of, if you go into certain parts of Brooklyn, boy, but you really will get your butt whipped. You'll
sure.
be, if not, you know, the ultimate ass whipping. That people will give.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not really sure that that's true. I've seen that.
That is true, Armand. No, Armand, we just a few years ago, actually it's more like 10 years ago, lost. As a matter of fact, Al Sharpton took a knife in the back protesting with a walk-on protest. My sister lived three blocks from Avenue X. I'm Afro-Cuban descent. And clearly of African descent by my appearance. She lived right around Avenue X. A man was, they beat him to death with baseball bats for going in a store. Words were exchanged, and the man was murdered. And this is like.
Okay, but let me back this up, okay? Because you're doing the same thing you're accusing the Italians of.
What's that?
Because you're becoming a proponent of that prejudice by saying
no,
the.
No,
but listen. I'm with you. I'm with you. Stay with me a minute, okay? A man walked into a store.
Yes.
And one out of a million people who have walked into stores in Brooklyn was beaten beyond belief by something that happened in the store, not
because he was black.
Yeah.
No, they didn't say that was the case.
You see what I mean? This is one out of a million people with crazy people always existing in the world.
Yeah.
So you can't say there that goes to prove it.
What I'm saying to you is, if, as a matter of fact, this was more than one person. It was a group of young thugs
sure.
that beat the guy to death with the baseball bat in the street.
Sure. And a group of police who beat to get the death of the guy they were trying to arrest. You know, there is always going to be an exception, but the exception doesn't make a rule. And what I'm saying is I believe, and I go into every neighborhood, and for some reason, nobody wants to hurt me.
I wouldn't want to hit you either.
What?
I'm sure I wouldn't want to hit you either, Ahmad.
No. But nobody wants to hit me because I'm not going in with that attitude. But maybe you and I should walk into that neighborhood together.
Oh, we don't want to take a knife in the back like Al Sharpton.
Oh, but, you know, keep in mind, this is Al Sharpton. Who is there protesting? Of course, if you're going to make noise and you're going to do things.
Black Muslims as a security protocol for him, which is like.
But what I'm suggesting to you, and we've got to get going. What I'm suggesting to you is one: we have to be careful because even as we repeat a story, we have to keep in mind this happened how many times, out of how many people. You know, and we'll hear about that one story.
I have Italian friends, but I think it's something peculiar. Just peculiar to the Italian-American community. I don't know about in Manhattan on the Lower East Side. I know about Brooklyn, which is where I grew up in Coney Island.
I know the cultures you're talking about.
I have friends, and I just, you know, even over all this. And you know,
well, listen, I have to be going.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I understand when people believe that about things, you know, but let me tell you a story before we go any further. Up where I live. I look outside in a place very near where I live. There's a nest with two little eggs. And in these eggs are two mourning doves. There's a mourning dove sitting on the eggs. I come to my office and I look outside the door and there are two baby pigeons who had just been given birth to. I'm being followed by little birds. So I thought, this must mean something. Here at this point in my life, I'm becoming parent, grandparent, or godfather to so many little baby birds. And from when I read about them, here's what I found out, that these baby birds, once they give birth to a bird and it's successful, they come back and they give more, they put more birds in the eggs, maybe four different sets of eggs. You know, going to be. So I decided to play some music for them. Since they listen to our program via the internet, I dug up a song for the mourning doves and the pigeons by Nancy Ames. This music is the most beautiful music by a woman, Nancy Ames, who is really from Ecuador, and she has an American name. And this beautiful music, which I'll be playing for you as soon as we get back from our break. But it is, it's a song to my birds around, including any of you who feel like birds. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Go.
Dicen que por las noches no más se le iba en puro llorar. Dicen que no comía, no más se le iba en puro tomar. Juran que el mismo cielo se estremecía al oír su llanto. Cómo sufrió por ella, ya está en su muerte, la fue llamando. Ay, 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 ay. Que una paloma triste, muy de mañana, le va a cantar a la casita sola con sus puertitas de par en par. Juran que esa paloma no es otra cosa más que su alma, que todavía la espera a que regrese la desdichada.
Nancy Ames, my friend, just cucurucuru paloma, the sound of the birds, which they actually, I can tell you, they make, because I hear them outside my window, makes you burst into tears. You know, tears, that's an interesting subject for you. Tears. Always coming when you least expect them. Now everybody in the street's looking at you and your eyes are blurry and you trip over your bumper and you stumble into the street and you're crying for no reason. Why? What are tears doing? There are days when you're crying and you can't understand, but everybody cries. For its capacity to signal physical or emotional distress, crying has left an indelible mark on the slate of human history. Where would art and poetry be without tears? In fact, where would we be without tears? You know, lacrima, as in lacrimal glands. Tears. Tears are the sweat of the heart. In truth, crying plays an essential role in our biology as well as our social and cultural experience. We can't stop the tears from flowing, but we can investigate why they flow. And why crying may not be, after all, such a bad thing to do. I can tell you that of the number of people who have come to my office, of the men, the ones who I have found suffer the very most are the ones who say, well, I haven't cried in a long time. And when I can in some way encourage a man or help a man get to his tears, and he could feel himself safe enough to dip all the way into the paroxysm of tears that lay under so many of us men, the pain that we live with our privacy and our belief that we have to be strong, and the pain that we endure just to try to get some meager stuff that we need. If we let the tears flow, it would be enormous. For the men who do that, who come to see me, the men who do that, they're usually so embarrassed they never want to look at me again. But it's a tremendous thing. It's a tremendous thing. It does so much for you. Tears are body excretions, you know, just like sweat, mucus, and urine. Those are all your body secretions. Usually don't like to think about body excretions, you know, we don't want to even hear about it. But when we do, we bear with them because we know they have important functions. Sweat removes excess salt from the body and cools us down. Mucus traps the surrounding pathogens. Urine and feces expel unneeded toxic waste products that would harm the body if they remained within it. All these contribute to the body's self-regulatory or homeostatic nature, readjusting it. Tears serve a biological, homeostatic purpose. But what? What do you think it is? Scientists have distinguished three kinds of tears, which differ from each other by function and probably by composition. If we were to examine them, we probably would see each one different. Basal tears actually form continuously. We don't experience these minute secretions as tears because they don't ball up as we used to tears doing. Instead, every time we blink, our eyelids spread the basal solution out over the surface of our eyeballs. Basal tears keep our eyes lubricated, important in preventing damage by air currents and bits of floating debris, you know, protects your eyes. Basal tears, like all tears, have numerous components. And so the main part of a tear contains predictably water and salt. That's why if you ever kiss somebody's tears, they taste salty. Have you never kissed somebody's tears? Have you ever kissed anybody's tears? It's a lovely thing to do, and that salt tells you something. The ratio of salt to water in tears is typically similar to that of the rest of the body. Okay, a thin layer of oil covers the tears outside to discourage it from falling out of the eye before its work has been done with the basal tears. So believe it or not, they have a little oily cover to hold it inside the eye so it can do the job. Then there are irritant tears, which we get hit by wind or sand or insects or rocks. Irritant or reflex tears, they have the same constituents as basal tears, and they work toward the same goal, protecting the eye. However, since they're designed to break down and eliminate eyeball intruders, these tears tend to flow in greater amounts and probably contain a greater concentration of, get this, antibodies and enzymes that target microorganisms. You want to learn about your hormonal system. Enough with studying your saliva. Let's study your tears. Let's see what's in there. Irritant tears are not just basal tears in greater quantity. Different biological processes precede the excretion of these two types of solutions. So there's basal tears, which are oil-covered kind of watery things to protect your eyes, which they're... And then there are these irritant tears, the reflex tears, and they're filled with other things. And then there's voluminous tears that so rapidly move us to frustration or pity. These are the emotional tears, secreted in moments of intense feelings, more often sorrow than joy, but sometimes in joy. These tears aren't there to cleanse the eyes or irritating microbes of debris. They do serve a purpose. The function of emotional tears can be inferred from their constituents. emotional tears contain much more than basal or irritant tears of a certain important ingredient, and that's proteins. Proteins! When you cry, the emotional tears have proteins. What do proteins do? Well, what can they do? We know very well they can be involved in anything and everything. The proteins found in emotional tears are hormones that have built up to a very high level when the body withstands emotional stress. So listen, if you're under emotional stress, cry. Cry. Let those tears shed some of the emotional stress, the hormonal stress that you're going through. It's natural. Of course, what happens to people is they feel the hormonal, emotional, biologically based stress, and they get angry instead. And what happens? No tears. If the chemicals associated with stress do not discharge, they would build up to toxic levels and weaken the body's immune system, and they would repeat themselves in the same process over and over again. So it takes work, and we've done this in psychotherapy for years. We have gotten people who have been under tremendous emotional stress, who feel either that sometimes it could be as simple as PMS, or it could be something as going through crisis or losses. We get them to cry. And we find that the tears are better than all the pills they could take. The state of clinical depression, in which the body's self-healing processes appear to shut down, including emotional tears. People who are deeply depressed don't have emotional tears. They have irritant tears, they have basal cell tears, but they don't have the emotional tears. They shut down. It's most likely exacerbated by a tearless victim's inability to adequately discharge their pent-up stress. The stress just stays in there. The psychologists refer to free weeping as an important stage in the healing process. And I knew one person, I remember her well, she would say to me, you know, every time when I get to that sensitive time of the month, she would go and rent films. And her favorite films that she would rent, videos, she would watch things like Sophie's Choice, you know, and she would rent films that would just guaranteed to make her cry. She said, I knew what I had to do was cry. That's what I had to do, not think. So she would go and she would force herself to cry, and she said, that was it. That's all I needed. Now, just to take it one step further, the major stress hormone released from the body via tears is prolactin. It's found to be much higher concentrated in women's bodies than in men. So if a woman is loaded with prolactin, what do you think she needs to do? Cry. It makes sense when you consider that the hormone is also implicated in the synthesis of breast milk. Interestingly, prolactin, which could make you feel so separate from somebody you love that it makes you stand at a distance, it appears to not only be secreted in tears, but also to play a role in the formation of tears. Levels of prolactin in the body correlate positively with frequency of emotional crying. As a whole, women who cry store less prolactin than women who don't. So, we're being given such terrific information. From an evolutionary perspective, why does it make sense for women to cry more often than men? It plays no minor role in our social interactions. Greater female weepiness is taken for granted. Don't men get as stressed out as women? Don't they need to release their tension just as much? Well, here's where prolactin plays a double role. In terms of increasing a person's vulnerability to feeling stress as well as a tendency to cry. In this case, among the men, the prolactin holds back the tears. So very often, women who are holding back their tears are in effect using a male model of stress release, which, as we know, doesn't work too well. Poor men. They take in more stress, they pour out more. The fact that men's tear glands are, as a whole, structurally smaller than women's supports the notions that they are useless. So anyway, my friends, tears. Tears, you know, you're a crier. Is that what it means? If you could let yourself do it. If you got somebody you love in your life. And they are seeming real, real irritable. See what you could do to make it safe enough for them to feel their tears. See what you could do. Because all the rage and all the anger and all the removing yourself from each other just continues along that way, and it makes you just continue that very same way. More anger, more removing, more separating. You don't think there's a solution. But if you're somebody who's always had a problem crying in front of people because it kind of led you to feeling more vulnerable, you're going to have a tendency not to do it. But what's going to happen is you're going to repeat it over and over and over again. Crying may be the very best path to true love. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Telephone number here, 212-209-2900. Just got time for a couple of calls, but I'd love to take them. If you're available, my friends. I wonder if my doves cry. Oh, isn't there a song, When Doves Cry? There is. It was by Prince. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Are we still on crowd control?
Yeah, if you're crying, to talk about it.
First of all, you said so many things before.
I know.
That, like, I was
I know.
Agreeing with you. But I just wanted to throw a little curveball in here. I find today that there is so much crowd control that it is stifling. There's so much quiet that it's frightening to me. People on a regular basis are sold out, you know, by their politicians or, you know, told what to do, like stand behind those lines at those anti-war protests.
Let me ask you a question.
And we don't protest.
Let me ask you a question.
I find that very, very troubling.
I do, yes. Too. Can I ask you a question? What's your name?
It's Gwen Goodwin.
Hello, Gwen.
And hey. I'm really stressed because I'm running for city council.
Gwen, that's what I'm asking
so
you.
So I'm trying.
Yeah,
to
I recognize your voice. Gwen, can I ask you something else?
Say it again.
Running for city council
is
a tough thing to do. When you run into that much stress, do you ever cry?
Well, you try to cry, but it's really hard. And I
it is. Tell me, but this is what I need from you. This is where you become my teacher. Gwen, stepping into city council asks you to step away from your more vulnerable self to step into a less vulnerable self. That's what it kind of commands, because it's a battlefield out there when you're going for politics. And you move away from your more vulnerable self to your less vulnerable self. And you try to cry, and you can't. Do you ever feel yourself holding the tears somewhere so far back that you would just love to let them go, and you can't?
Yes.
Yeah, you're great. You're great. Do you ever think you could find a way to release them? You know, this is what I wish. I wish I could see more of our politicians shed a tear.
I have to say that I don't have a thick skin. I have a very thin skin.
Huh?
And so it's very, very hard for me. I mean, the only reason why I am doing this is because of the amount of feelings and anger and compassion that have been generated in me through all the years that I've lived in East Harlem. And so I'm not running for what the typical reasons are people run. I'm running because I do think that the silence is deafening. I can't stand to see my people that live in this neighborhood trot all over again. And they do need somebody that cares and wants to get out there and really do something. In the meantime, it's very, very hard for me to hold back those tears because, honestly, it's not in my nature. I don't have thick skin at all. I have thin skin. So, you know, instead of crying, I go have a piece of pizza, and that's not working out either. This is not the right way either.
I appreciate your call, and I love your honesty, Gwen. I love your honesty.
Thank you.
I wish you luck.
Okay.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hi, my name is Kathy. I'm calling your show for the first time, and I'm
Hi there. Congratulations. Are you nervous?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, I could hear it.
Yeah.
It's good. You could be nervous. Just take your time. Take your time.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to be on the same subject of crowd control.
How about on crying? We were talking about crying. Sounds to me, Cassie, that you've been crying lately.
Well, you're right about that one.
Yeah, I could hear it. I could hear it in your voice. What's been causing you so much pain?
Well, I came from a messed up family, and what happened, I hate to really say this, but I'm trying to write a book. I really don't like to speak out loud what I'm doing because, you know, sometimes people send out bad vibes.
Yeah, you think there are people in your family who don't wish the best for you, huh?
Yes.
I hear. That's a real pity. I wish the best for you, Cassie.
Yes.
I wish the absolute best. I want you to be as happy as you could possibly be. But it must hurt to go through life believing that there are people out there who really want to hurt you.
Yeah, it does. But then after a while, you have to deal with it.
Yeah, you deal with it all the time. Of course you do.
Yeah, every day, you know. So I'm trying to, you know, put a little book together, which is giving me a hard time and which is making me cry. I thought it would be easy, but it's the hardest thing, writing a book. It's not easy.
Yeah. Well, every tear you shed, you know, makes those pages a little more lively and a little more real. So you got my support, Cassie. Send me a copy of it when you get it.
Okay.
Whether it's published or not, send me a copy. I'd love to see it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for calling
Bye.
In. 212-209-2900. Time for one more call, if we could get it in there. Hi, this is Armand Demiller on the air.
Hello. Leora, this is Leora.
Leora, it's been so long. Hello, Leora.
Well, I wanted to share. I have a little Leora. And so when something hits me in terms of my life journey, and I cry, I pick up my little girl, Leora. I hold her tight, and I tell her, just keep crying. And I hold her and tell her just let her cry. What do you think about using the inner child form?
Well, Leora, you're so skilled at what you do, and you know how to work with it. It's a wonderful form.
Yes?
It's a wonderful form, sure.
Sure,
sometimes you could just take a pillow sometimes and hold it in your arms and make believe it's a smaller version of you and just say, you know, I'll take care of you.
Yes.
I'll take care of you. Absolutely, Leora.
I just thought I would share that with you.
I thank you so much, and it's nice to hear your voice again.
It just relieves it, and there you go. You're in the present moment, and you go on with your journey.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Leora.
You're so welcome.
Bye-bye. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. So next week is an unusual week. Next week, I will not be with you on Tuesday and Wednesday, but I will be with you for a two-hour special, and it's a surprise, on Thursday. Make a note in your calendar from 1 to 3 p.m. Then the following week, I'll be with you again, not on Tuesday, but on Wednesday and Thursday. So you may make a note. If not, you could check with my schedule. My special thanks to you. And everybody out there for your help with this. I will be back with you very shortly. If you want to send me an email, you can send it armand@thepositivemind.com. Be sure to support the station, my friends. It does wonderful things. Be back with you next week. My mistake. I'll be with you Wednesday and Thursday. It's the following week that I won't be on. I'll be on Wednesday and Thursday, and then the following week I won't be on Tuesday and Wednesday. Thank you for straightening that out.
por las noches no más se le iba en puro llorar. Dicen que no comía, no más se le iba en puro tomar. Juran que el mismo cielo se estremecía al oír su llanto. Como sufrió por ella, ya está en su muerte, la fue llamando. Ay, 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 ay.
And good afternoon once again. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide. I'm the chief announcer at WBAI. The station has been on an upswing in